Okay, again, this is the 9/11 teleconference for 3/26/14. Present on the call are Dwayne Dietz, Jamie Hufford, Rich Epcoin, Ned Delaney, and from the film Unthinkable, Eric Stacey, Dennis Fitzpatrick, and Wayne Madison. Anybody else on the call whose name I missed? Okay, hearing none, then, introducing Eric Stacey, the filmmaker of Unthinkable, An Airline Captain's Story. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, good evening. Unthinkable, An Airline Captain's Story. Just for your reference, and if you're in front of a computer as we're discussing the film, you might want to go to unthinkable-movie.com, which is it's a WordPress site, but it's treated like a website, and there's some interesting information there that you might want to refer to either during the call or later. I first became aware of the Philip Marshall murder, in quote, murder-suicide, depending on who you're talking to. It's either a murder or a murder-suicide. Via Barbara Honegger, who we'd been discussing another film, and when the murder came up on the news a little more than a year ago, Wayne and me to it, and I found it very interesting. I did not know Wayne at the time. We've since become colleagues and friends. And in a nutshell, Philip Marshall was an author of three books. The first was a fiction piece based on his experience as a contract pilot for the CIA flying Barry Seal during the Iran-Contra days. He later went on to fly with Eastern Airlines and then United Airlines for approximately 20 years, racking up over 15,000 hours as a captain in Boeing heavy passenger jets. And in 2001, and shortly thereafter, being a captain with United meant that you were one of an entire group of employees who owned stock. It was an ESOP. So United, as I think we all know, the stock was shorted by persons unnamed, and went from, you know, a valuable stock to an almost worthless stock, and the airline was then taken over by Wall Street banks, which did not make Philip Marshall happy at all, and may be part of his motivation for writing his subsequent books, 9/11, False Flag, 9/11, and the big Bamboozle, both of which look at 9/11 from the point of view of an airline captain with considerable time in the cockpit, who wrote initially about the difficulty that, or the contradictions that he found in the stories that came through the mainstream press about terrorist pilots being capable of taking over a heavy jet with only a few hours of training in a single-engine Cessna. He branched out from that perspective and did a considerable amount of research, which led to the two books. And when we begin to speak of the murder-suicide and the reportage from the law enforcement community, his hometown of Murphy's, California, what we begin to see are two completely opposing stories. From law enforcement, we learn that he was psychotic, that he was abusing prescription drugs, that he was depressed and despondent over his impending divorce, and that that's enough about that. The one side, Wayne may want to jump in a little later to give us some more background on that. The other side was that he had written books with considerable information that those in positions of power would find alarming. Because what he did basically was to write at length about the many ways in which a secret government was formed, and in a nutshell took over the United States government, beginning with his experience as the CIA contract pilot for Barry Seal, because a year or so after he had finished that employment with the CIA, with a Learjet charter company at Lakefront, Louisiana, he saw a gentleman on television in front of a congressional committee who he knew very well as one of his bosses during these frequent trips that he flew between Central America and Louisiana and Mena, Arkansas.
Excuse me, the he here is still... Is Barry Seal or is Philip Marshall?
Now, the gentleman that he saw, he saw a gentleman on television in front of a congressional committee.
Yeah, but who's the he? Who saw this? Barry Seal or?
Oh, no. Phillips.
Okay.
Phillips. And the gentleman that was in front of Congress was wearing a Marine Lieutenant Colonel's uniform and was named Oliver North. And it was at that point that Marshall began to realize that the government was not being run from the Oval Office, but it was being run out of the basement of the White House by George Bush, James Baker, and Oliver North, with the assistance of Fawn Hall. So he basically put a microscope over everything he could that had to do with these the Bush folks and how they sort of step by step took over took over the country. I have, you know, 5 pages of just like bullet points of information that that would terrify, I think terrify is a good word, those in the intelligence community. And he very clearly laid out in The Big Bamboozle how the intelligence community was taken over via a deception that was made in the year preceding the 9/11 attacks. In which he showed how false information was planted about Osama bin Laden planning a takeover. I mean, planning these attacks.
Excuse me. If anybody has got a problem with keeping the noise down, if you press *6, it will mute your phone while somebody else is speaking. You can always press *6 to get back in the conversation. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
So I'm just going to read a few of these points that I found particularly of interest. That I precede that by saying that the controversy over Phil Marshall's death there was never really a motive that surfaced at least in the mainstream media. There was actually almost no coverage at all of his murder in the mainstream media. And that may have been because of what he wrote, because the media is so averse to dealing with anything but the official story. But what Marshall had written about was were the many points that that we see, you know, in The Big Bamboozle, which is. He alleges that no one was interested in stopping the 9/11 plot. The result of the false impression that Osama bin Laden led 9/11 is that the Bush intelligence community remains in control of every armed authority of the federal government. He speaks about the fear tactics the intelligence community has used to prevent Khalid Sheikh Mohammed from being brought to trial, effectively derailing our system of justice. He talks about the pervasive nature of the intelligence community today, a confederacy with nearly a million people on its payroll, over 800,000 with top secret clearances. He talks about the Department of Homeland Security planning to link into every county sheriff, city police office, and eventually conduct pat-downs at every train and bus station in our nation, all based on the fear created by this myth of Osama bin Laden. He talks at length about the nature of creating a false flag and gives an example of saying, imagine you wanted to murder your neighbor Bob and pin it on Crazy Fred at the end of the street, who has been threatening for years to do Bob in. But when Bob is finally killed, if you play your cards right, who's going to believe it wasn't Fred? So we've been told 1,000 times that bin Laden was behind the attacks, but the Washington Post on May 25th, 2010 reported that a psychops group within Special Activities Division was caught producing fake bin Laden videos. They also traced the Al-Qaeda press releases to a U.S. intelligence contractor called SITE, S-I-T-E, a Pentagon subcontractor that appears to be Al-Qaeda's press department. He talks about the fact that Americans have never been afforded a single piece of evidence that confirmed that bin Laden was ever in the raided house, or one piece of evidence that he was killed. There was no trial, no jury, no judge, just a claim that originated deep within the intelligence community and reported in a month-long media blitz as fact. He talks about how Dick Cheney used the 9/11 attacks to frighten America, hotwiring direct to the attack. He talks about how Cheney threatened the head of a federal investigation. He talks about how Cheney provided critical disinformation to the media about bin Laden, Saddam, and weapons of mass destruction. He talks about how Cheney warned us about anthrax attacks and a possible mushroom cloud that required an immediate military response. He talks of Cheney ordering torture and stonewalling any investigation into the military failures that allowed 9/11 to succeed. He led the charge to open Guantanamo and the opposition to close it. He goes into examining a number of points that came up from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, which is co-chaired by Senator Bob Graham, who said there was a direct line between the terrorists and the government of Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government had provided logistical and financial support to at least two of the 9/11 hijackers while they lived in Southern California. He says, led by Dick Cheney, the intelligence community was allowed to tamper with the inquiry's report, redacting 28 pages that dealt with Saudi involvement. That would have to do with the H.R. 428 issue that you guys are so interested in. Clearly Phil Marshall was not someone that anyone higher up in the intelligence community or the Saudis wanted people to take seriously. And although we don't point fingers in the film as to who was responsible for the murder, in portraying the side in opposition to the law enforcement story, we're basically focusing on the terrible police work, the contradictions in matters of fact between the sheriff's report and what Wayne Madsen found when he visited. My interest in making the film is to create, it's not exactly the right word, but it's an entertainment piece which reflects on an important story that is otherwise not covered by the mainstream media, and hopefully by getting people who would otherwise, stay away from another quote-unquote conspiracy theory project, it may open some doors to their looking a little further because of the extraordinary contradictions between the two poles that are represented in the story. Dennis and Wayne, if you want to jump in, might be interesting to have you
Well, I'll just add to that. I did not know Phil Marsh before I read about this incident, which happened just before Super Bowl Sunday last year. I was not familiar with his books. So when I went out there, I was really, you know, a person who had no previous association with him, although I may have met him at the 10th anniversary of 9/11, the event in New York. There was a guy who looked an awful lot like him, and I described what he was wearing. I do remember he was kind of dressed kind of like California Mufti to some of his family members. They said, "Yeah, well, that's kind of stuff he wore." So it was a very quick meeting. But I certainly don't remember other than, you know, saying hi to him, anything in greater detail. So really, I went out there with an open mind. I was very, very interested in this story about this that he murdered his two kids, and then he shot himself with this Glock, which I discovered he, up until fairly recent, before this incident, he didn't even have ammunition for. He said, "Yeah, I have it, but you know, a lot of good it'll do me." Now, in the movie, you'll see that the character that Dennis plays, Madison Freeman, and I have to add that if the character is based on me, the homework was absolutely well done on that, because there are many scenes of me talking to sources in a bar, and that is absolutely right on the money. So I plead guilty on that. As anybody who knows me in Washington knows, that's where I usually got a lot of my information from, meeting sources or talking to various people that work in those places. But anyway, I detected something was wrong with the story from the get-go. Now, I did make an attempt to talk to the official media, which is the Calaveras Enterprise. It's a 150-year-old newspaper that was doing a lot of in-depth reports, but basically all they were doing was restating the details from the Calaveras County Sheriff Department about the incident. Now, the Calaveras Enterprise is a weekly newspaper. They've been around since, I guess, the last big story they covered before the Phil Marshall case was the trial of Black Bart back in the 1800s, the infamous robber during the gold rush time. It was clear that the paper, which exists mostly because of advertising revenue, could not afford to do any sort of independent investigation because they're slave to the Sheriff's Department, which provides them with all their blotter information every week that they use in their paper. So there was sort of a platonic relationship between the only newspaper in town and the Sheriff's Department. Now, there were a couple other papers that covered it, and I have to say they were all very, very hostile, to the point that one decided to interview Phil Marshall's former wife, who we hadn't seen in 18 years, who lived in Louisiana, was not even aware of anything he was doing on 9/11. And of course, as with most ex-wives, she had nothing good to say about him. Said that, you know, he drank a lot. And I did try to contact the editor of that particular newspaper, and they refused to talk to me. So the media in the area of Calaveras County, which is the town of San Andreas, Angel Camp, which was popularized, of course, with the frog jumping stories of from Mark Twain, who spent some time out there. And this small town, Murphy's, Forest Meadows, which was a gated community where Phil Marshall lived, pretty much the official community believed the sheriff's department when they said that he, in a fit of anger, shot his 18-year-old son, or 17-year-old son, and his 14-year-old daughter, shot the family dog, and then turned the weapon on himself. I gained access to the gated community, and I was the only, as far as I know, I was the only journalist who actually cased the outside of his home because they were keeping news crews out. The television trucks and whatnot were being kept out by the security guard at the main gate. I was invited in by his neighbor. I also, it was very clear to me that the neighbor who was the first one to see him inside the home distinctly recalled that the entrance wound of the bullet that, of course, the police, the sheriff said, you know, he shot himself in the head. Entrance wound was on the left side of his head, and Phil Marshall was right-handed. So we, right there, and we had the coroner saying, no, the entrance wound was on the left, or right side of the head, I should say. That was a fundamental flaw. The other thing was, none of the neighbors, these homes are on the side of a mountain, basically a mountain ridge, so they're not only close, fairly close together horizontally, but they tend to be also close vertically because you've got some homes higher in elevation than the adjacent homes. So the question arose about if he used this clock, why didn't the neighbors hear any gunshots? And the sheriff's department put out the information that the homes were far apart. Well, clearly anyone who went into that subdevelopment realized that those homes were not that far apart. As a matter of fact, Phil's neighbor said she could hear him whistling inside his home. That's how close she was to that home. So, and she never heard any kind of gunshot whenever this incident took place. And that's even questionable. The sheriff ruled at the time of death was when the bodies were discovered. Sometime after the children didn't show up to school, and there were some questions, some concerns raised amongst their schoolmates, their school friends, about why they missed school on that Friday. And so the bodies were discovered in the early afternoon on Saturday, and that's when the coroner ruled at the time of death. So the sheriff also said there was no outside interference. Well, clearly there were state of California SUVs present at the Marshall residence. The day I was present at his home, that very night his home was broken into. Somebody gained access through a glass sliding door in the back of the home, and that was reported by the sheriff's department. So it was quite clear that whatever Marshall had, there was still an interest by somebody to gain access to that home to try to find out what he had. The other very interesting thing is when I arrived there, there were banker's boxes in front of the front door. Now, either they were leftover boxes from files being removed, or they were the boxes that contained Marshall's files, and the files had been removed. His hard disk, he was working on yet another book. Eric mentioned the two previous books about 9/11 and the one about his the novel about his time with Barry Seal and flying for the CIA. He was working on yet another book about 9/11, and he I attended Marshall's memorial service, which was held about a month and a half later in Mandeville, Louisiana, which is on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans. And from what his family told me, he had a very keen interest in the Marana Airfield, otherwise known as the Pinal Airport. That's the location of the civilian aircraft boneyard, where there's a lot of commercial aircraft that have been taken out of service are parked there, but they tend not to rust, so they can be brought into service again fairly rapidly because they're just parked out in the dry desert, and the only thing that they do is protect the engines from the dust, so they put cowlings over the engines. But many times planes are taken out of that facility, repainted, and sold back to various airlines, charter companies, so forth and so on. Now, from what I gather, his interest was the possibility that some of the planes used on 9/11 may have been actually brought out of the boneyard, and this gets into the issue about what aircraft, you know, some people said, well, they didn't look like commercial aircraft. They looked like they had been refitted, so forth and so on. This obviously was where he was heading, but we'll never really know because his hard disk that had his manuscript for his fourth book disappeared. Well, it didn't disappear. It was taken into custody by the California Department of Justice in their crime lab, and as far as I know, they have never released it. So that throws a monkey wrench into the sheriff's contention that it was only a county matter and there was no outside interference by any other law enforcement. Right there, we know that the state of California seized his hard disk and was obviously going through it looking for something. But I'll turn it over to Dennis, who I think did a great job in portraying the investigative journalist who goes out there to try to dig through all this flack that the sheriff's department was putting up, and also using the community, especially the friends of the Marshall children, being used to basically demonize Phil Marshall, and I think that was portrayed very well in the movie.
Well, thanks, Wayne. My involvement with this comes off of and continuing interest in the issues that we spoke that were raised in the film came from two comments that Eric has made. One was that when we first did a kind of an in-house screening for a small group of people, Eric said in the front of the room that he took it very personally, that this man had died a death that was unexplained and led to larger issues. And that was the impact that the film had, being involved in the film, had on me as well. I did. I took it personally. And as a result, have kept myself busy with a phenomenal amount of reading, both before filming and since, in an ongoing interest not only to educate myself, but hopefully have an educated dialogue with a number of other professional contacts about, you know, the whole issue surrounding 9/11, which is an enormous issue. That's still left unaddressed. The other is when Eric just recently said that the film hopes to reach people who, you know, are not concerned about the crazy fringe conspiracy theorists, which is a phrase that immediately puts people in a category and basically ends conversation. But that hopefully, you know, some folks will venture forth, see the film, and begin to ask their own questions as a result. And that is a very powerful weapon when people take it to heart for themselves rather than, you know, being told which way they should look. So anyhow, that's pretty much all I have to say at this point.
Well, for folks that haven't seen the film, I'm sure interest has really been stimulated by this series of presentations. Before we go to Q&A, I need to ask who the most recent caller was to come on the call.
Mike Booth came on.
Mike Booth. Hey, welcome, Mike.
Thanks.
Which group are you with, Mike, again?
Indiana.
Indiana 9/11 Truth?
Grassroots, yeah.
Oh, Indiana Grassroots 9/11 Truth?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. All right, so... Okay, so we can move it to Q&A, and thank you all, three of you, for showing up tonight and giving us this look forward, and maybe also before you know, we leave the subject, at some point you might want to talk about what we can do to help stimulate an interest in the film and how the film is going to be distributed, how people can get a hold of copies of it, and so forth and so on. Who would like...
At this point, okay. Ken, just let me just jump in for just a second.
Go ahead.
To say that we're opening the film in New York at the Quad Cinema, which is in Greenwich Village on 13th Street, 34 West 13th Street, April 11th through the 17th. We will have, the film will be reviewed by the New York Times, the Village Voice, and hopefully a few other publications that have film writers that people pay attention to. And depending on, hopefully someone will say something good about the film and not dismiss it, you know, as a crazy conspiracy theorist film.
Eric, I should add that I found out yesterday there'll be a reporter from the Huffington Post covering at the premiere, as well as someone from the German press.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful,
cool.
And in addition to the you know, to the media side of the film's opening, distribution is keyed very closely to how many tickets are sold. You know, we're all familiar with the big blockbusters that are doing $50 million in the first week. Well, people pay attention to the little tiny independent films that, you know, that may fill a few thousand seats over a weekend, or maybe even less than 1,000. That could be considered very successful and open a door or two to more mainstream distribution of the film, so that you know, we can go into other cities and online in you know, places like Netflix and iTunes and all the rest of the the video on demand universe. So if anyone would like to come and see it, we'd love to see you there. If you'd like to tell your friends about it, we'd love to see them. And that's all I have to say about, you know, the immediate future of the film. A lot will depend on how we do in New York.
Okay. And that's on the 11th, right, that live film will start?
Correct. The 11th through the 17th.
Okay. Okay. Does anybody have a question or a comment for our guests?
This is Ned Delaney.
Ned, okay, I'll put you first. Who else? Okay, I'll go next. Go ahead, Ned.
Yeah, would you restate the date and the time for the showing of that movie?
Oh, April 11th.
April 11th.
We open on the 11th, and it plays five shows a day through the following Thursday. Actually, the last day we're having something called the Off the Wall Film Festival with a number of other films in addition to Unthinkable, including TWA 800, Barbara Honegger's film Behind the Smoke Curtain, the Grand Deception, I think it's called, about the Panama Canal, the number of, you know, political films that some of which touch on aircraft downings and controversies.
And that's in Greenwich Village?
Yeah. Okay. 34 West 13th Street. The name of the theater is Quad, Q-U-A-D, Cinema.
Q-U-A-D, Cinema.
And I guess I could, if I may add that you know, there was a question there about what could folks do. This is the kind of thing where, you know, word of mouth, social media, just encouraging friends, neighbors, people that you know of interest to just inform as many people as you can, so that it just becomes a possibility for them to see the film or speak of it and request it for, you know, for group showings somewhere.
How would one do that?
Eric?
Contact me at info@landfallprods.com. LANDFALLPRODS.com. We don't have DVDs available yet. It's not online yet. You know, this April 11th opening will determine when and where the film may become available, but it will become available soon after. And if you write me at info@landfallprods.com, I'd be happy to point you to sources for seeing the film as they develop.
Okay. Anything else, Ned?
No, thank you.
Okay. Eric, I was very impressed with what you had to say tonight regarding 9/11. And it's clear you have your head on straight from the standpoint of 9/11 truth. But in watching the film, I was less impressed because it seemed as though, even though in the beginning, some of the contradictions that you're talking about were very well presented, were very well articulated, particularly in the scene where Phil says, you know, how impossible it would seem for even a practice pilot to, you know, go through those maneuvers and so forth. I mean, that, you know, this is the boilerplate from 9/11 truth. But then later in the film, it seems as if the great revelation might have been that, in fact, one of these pilots got advanced training such that he might have been able to actually do that. Did I misconstrue something there, or is that what the film actually says?
I think you're right. It points toward that. There's one scene in particular where the Wayne Madsen character is talking to an airline trainer. He is actually, his quest, the film investigator's quest is to find out not only who may have wanted to see Marshall dead, but why, and what we learn through the film is that there are mysterious agents who have come to take possession of a highly classified photograph that's been sent to Marshall, which he has told others will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt who was behind 9/11. Well, we never see the photograph. We only see an envelope that it arrives in. We see where it's hidden, and at the end, it disappears in the possession of one of the Marshall kids' friends. Mm-hmm. Now that's all fiction, but it's fiction which is representative of the state of affairs we're dealing with today, because you know, along the way we learn from one of the police officers that the FBI has advised local police to treat anyone suspected of harboring conspiracy theories as a potential terrorist. So we're really more than trying to prove specific points. We're trying to establish how the political and moral character of the country is under attack based on these terrorist myths. I hope that somewhat answers your question.
Yeah, if I could add, Ned, I know what you're talking about, the guy that comes on the motorcycle and starts talking about you know, whoever did this had some advanced training. I think that really just goes to show what we just heard in the last couple of weeks about the Malaysian plane, with all the theories out there from so-called experts. You know, none of them agree. We heard, you know, everything about the pilot and the co-pilot hijacking the plane, to them being overcome by some sort of fumes and turning around and they flew almost to Antarctica. I think that kind of discussion that the reporter has with this trainer well, again, in a bar, it really exemplifies what I faced in looking at 9/11 over the last several years, is that, you know, you just meet people that have good credentials, but they have different, you know, different views on things. And I can say, you know, Dan Hofsicker down here in Florida, I mean, who I know very well, he doesn't believe that Marshall was murdered. He thinks he actually did, you know, shoot his kids and himself. So, you know, I mean, there's going to always be disagreements about these things, especially when law enforcement goes out of their way to do these cover-ups, as they did in the case of Phil Marshall. It was a massive cover-up. As far as I know, we can't even exhume any. Well, I know at least with the Marshall case, none of the bodies can be exhumed anyway because they were all cremated.
Without the permission of the family.
Richard, yeah. Are you still on the line?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Before you go, I want to ask another question that will sort of set the stage for what you want to say. But I think you know, it's easier for me to separate two different themes in this movie. One is, of course, about the Marshall murders and all that. And I think that part is extremely, you know, well presented and well developed dramatically. But as a pedagogical vehicle for people who are not yet familiar with 9/11 truth and who would, as several of you have said, be distanced from it simply because they regard it as so much conspiracy theory, to raise the right questions, as you do in the beginning of the film, and then to sort of reinforce the official story in a left-handed way by suggesting, well, maybe it did go like they say, but it was because, you know, somebody had advanced training to be able to pull this off. Just seems to me that it brings the genie out of the bottle only to try to put him back in again. But that's just my take on it. But the other criticism I would offer is, it's not necessarily criticism, it's kind of a devil's advocate position, but there have been theories for a long time that the government has various fallback positions in case the official 9/11 version gets too hard to maintain. And one of those is to blame everything on Saudi Arabia, and many people thought that that's what Senator Graham was about, that he was basically, you know, coming up with fallback position that, well, yeah, it's true that, you know, the official story is false, but it's because Saudi Arabia, rather than, you know, Osama bin Laden is behind it or something, you know. And so a lot of people in the dialogue truth movement are skeptical about that approach. But I've seen, you know, very good counter arguments to that, and I think Rich, you know, this is a good time for you to chime in, if you wish, about why pursuing that angle could be fruitful for the 9/11 truth movement. Go ahead.
Sure.
I was just going to say, may I say one thing before we move on?
Sure.
And that is the film itself, again, to reiterate what Eric said at the beginning, it's not as much, you know, it's to tell that story about that individual, but also just begin to open doors, you know, to allow people to open the doors for themselves. So it's about raising an individual's awareness about maybe they're just not getting the whole story. And if that, you know, can, you know, if it can contribute to that, I think that the film, you know, has, you know, has, I'd be proud to be, you know, contributing to that possibility.
Okay.
Listen, Ned.
Oh, well, wait a minute, Ned. Rich, did you want to tell us about that HR bill and why you think it's a fruitful approach?
Well, yeah, sure. Before I do, though, I haven't seen this movie. I tried watching it online, so the reason I'm not commenting on it is because I haven't seen it. But I'm wondering if it touches on the possibility of remote commandeering of the airliners.
I don't think so, does it,
no.
Eric?
No. No, it doesn't at all.
I was just curious about that, because that was something I noticed in the coverage of the Flight 370 over the past couple weeks is the presumption by all of the talking heads and everyone else talking about it that whoever, if it was hijacked, whoever hijacked it would have had to have been on the plane. And I don't think that's necessarily true. And but anyway, back to H.R. 428. I was of the inclination to write it off and not, you know, not pursue it, not call my congressman, not do anything with it, because I was suspicious also. Anytime you see Congress people, you know, call me jaded, call me cynical. I just don't trust them. I don't trust any of them, really.
Yeah.
With the Ron Paul, and he's not there anymore.
James Hufford, I'd like to speak in turn.
Okay, James, I'll put you on the stack, and I've got Ned there, too. Keep going, Rich.
Yeah, but then I remembered a conversation I had with a guy named Joe Bergantino. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was the I-Team reporter who had investigated PTAC in 2002 and had his report quashed by the White House. Now, I assume everyone on this call is familiar with PTAC, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, so it was a Saudi, a Saudi-owned business here in Quincy, Massachusetts, that created the software. And you know, Indira Singh she was an IT consultant or some kind of risk management consultant who stumbled upon their software and realized, you know, because the guy who owned it was a suspected terrorist. He was on a terrorist list, and so she saw. You know, alarms were going off all over the place, so she tried to contact the FBI. She wasn't getting anywhere. She tried to contact other government agencies. No one would listen to her. So she ended up going to Joe Bergantino. Now, Joe Bergantino actually grew up in the same neighborhood as I did. I had a loose kind of association with him in that way, but I did email him and started asking him questions about it. And at first, he was open about it and corroborated everything Indira Singh had said. And yeah, and you know they shut down my investigation. They didn't. He portrayed it as they were embarrassed because, you know, they had gotten caught with their pants down, and they didn't really want to make that public. But of course, Indira Singh thinks it's far more insidious than that, and nefarious than that. So I started to realize that if we're going to talk about a Saudi connection, it's okay to do as long as we make sure we're bringing PTAC into it, because as Indira Singh says, it is a golden thread that if you pull it, the whole thing unravels. So I think it's worth doing as long as we make sure to weave in the PTAC angle. I don't know what's in those 28 pages, and if it is a red herring, then we're not going to see anything about PTAC in there. But if we, in our campaign to expose it, in our conversations with our congressmen, in our talk on talk radio calling and letters to the editor, if we bring it up and we weave it in, then it becomes worthwhile to me. And that's what I've been doing. I've been talking to my congressman, Jim McGovern. I have been calling into radio shows, bringing it up, writing letters to the editor.
And I would just encourage everybody else to do that because I see it as a potential opportunity. And if it is a red herring, we got nothing really to lose. They're not coming out with the truth tomorrow anyway.
Make the case for why that thread will unravel the rest of it.
Well, because the software was in the FAA, the CIA, the FBI. There's magic software that caused all the confusion that day, along with the drills, was in all these government agencies. And then George Bush and Dick Cheney tried to stop the investigation into it. Indira Singh says she has proof of that, and Bergantino essentially has admitted to it too, that his investigation was shut down by the White House. Now, the problem I'm having with Joe Bergantino now, when this resolution was floated, I contacted him again, but he's no longer willing to talk. He has since gone quiet. So, unfortunately, I think it would really be great if he'd be willing. I want him to call Congressman Lynch and say, hey, how can I help? And how can the Saudi connection, obviously, TPEC is a big part of that, and I investigated it, so how can I help you? And I was really hoping to make that establish that link. And, maybe I can't do it myself, but if enough people started bringing it up, I'm hopeful that it could make a difference and make it worth pursuing.
Okay, well, Rich, we could have you back on another call and we could discuss this at further length because I think it's useful to pursue understanding understand what the campaign's about, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Let's see, James, and then go ahead, James.
Okay, I'd just like to comment on a couple of things that were mentioned. First of all, James Corbett seems to lean toward the theory of remote guidance of the airplane, of the Malaysia plane. And also regarding that plane, incident, what really has stood out to me that alerted me right away was that within about 10 minutes after the plane disappeared, it became suddenly the big news trumpeted, I don't know, across the United States anyway, by our media. I don't know about in the whole world, but that's unusual because usually when a foreign airliner goes down in a remote part of the world from here, it might get a paragraph on page 16 in the paper or maybe one sentence on the nightly news, and that's about it. There wasn't anything particularly unusual about, planes do go down from time to time, but they they just were striving to focus everybody's attention on that, and I assumed right away that they did it because there was a lesson for everybody in it from their standpoint, and so I thought that it was some sort of a inside job, and I've always tended to think that James Corbett's probably right, that it seemed like something that's more likely remotely guided than pilot error or gas on the plane, smoke in the plane, or whatever, to me. Just how I feel about it.
The lead editorial in today's Wall Street Journal is someday soon all passenger jets will be remote. It will be drones. Just for what that's worth.
Yeah.
Okay, Ned, you're next.
Yeah, I have a question. Wayne, we may have discussed this at one time, and then also Eric be interested in this. It's my understanding that the September preceding the Marshall killing or suicide death, Marshall was on coast to coast, was interviewed by John Wells. Was any of that, that transcript is available online if you go to coast to coast. I don't know whether it's on YouTube or not.
I used portions of it in the film.
Okay. I was just wondering if any of that was incorporated.
Yep.
I should also add on this House resolution, one thing I was not able to actually confirm, but I did talk to some people who knew Phil Marshall, friends and relatives, and he may have been in touch with Senator Bob Graham, who was the chairman of, I believe he was in contact. Now, I attempted to, I sent Graham, and I managed to get his private email and asked him, you know, were you in touch with this guy, Phil Marshall? I never got a response, but for those who may not be aware, Senator Graham wrote a novel about a former our State Department officer who has some smoking gun evidence about the Saudi role in 9/11, and then he gives this information to a retired U.S. senator who lives on his farm in the state in southern Florida. I think the guy's name is Billington, Senator Billington, but Senator Billington is struck and killed by a pickup truck on the road. Now, it's quite clear, and I know someone who spoke to Graham. Graham thought that was him. That's what he put. He put himself in his own novel as a senator who's killed because he knows too much about, you know, the real perpetrators behind 9/11. So, if Marshall had gotten any information about what was in the missing 28 pages, again, I'm not saying I know this for a fact, but that certainly could have led to his his being killed. Now, one would ask, well, why get the kids? Well, the kids would have been with their mother that particular week, but she was over in Turkey on a shopping. She her husband, although they were going to be divorced, her husband, it was an amicable divorce. She had been a previously had been a buyer for Nordstrom's department store, and he wanted to set her up in a business where she could import goods from Turkey, things like soaps and linens and saffron and stuff like that, and then just resell that to boutique shops in Northern California. So she went over there on a buying trip. So she was out of the country. But her kids would have normally been with her that week because it was she lived closer to their high school. But because she was gone, they were at their father's house. So whoever was assigned to take out Marshall, you know, stumbled upon the kids, and of course, you know, that would explain why they were killed as well.
But Marshall looked into the joint congressional inquiry and wrote about it fairly extensively. Not the 28 missing page, redacted pages, but he did a pretty careful analysis of important information that he said was tucked way deep in the, you know, in the back of the report. And, you know, he mentioned people like Omar al-Bayoumi, who is a Saudi intelligence agent, who went directly from the Saudi consulate to a meeting with the hijackers the day they arrived. He said Bayoumi's also identified as the Saudi Civil Aviation Authority contact who remained, you know, in touch with the hijackers throughout their training, and who also delivered $400,000 from Saudi Arabia to the Kurdish mosque in San Diego, all of which apparently came via Prince Bandar's wife, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who was the ambassador to Saudi Arabia at the time.
Okay,
just a point of just clarification, those 28 pages were not redacted, they were excised.
Excised. They're just blank.
Good point. Ned, did you get your chance to ask your question there?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, we don't want to detain you guys any further. We tried to keep it as close to 45 minutes as we could, and we appreciate everything that you've been informing us about. The recording will be available to all the other people who are activists around the country who are on our network, and we'll encourage everybody to listen in and take an interest in the movie and support it in whatever way they can, because there are very few inroads right now to the 9/11 truth issue in the art world, and this certainly would pique some interest if it were successful. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having us, John.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
All right.
Okay. Is anyone... I hope we're still on the call here. Has anybody joined the call? Who's still on the call?
Ned?
Dwayne?
Dwayne?
Yeah, James.
James.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we lost some people.
Right. So we still have another issue to deal with here, and I appreciate you guys sticking it out. Not a very comfortable issue, but one that we really need to address. Ned brought to our attention what might be regarded as a breach of protocol on our last call when maybe you'd like to paraphrase it, Ned, since you put it on the agenda, but maybe just repeat to the others, because I don't think any of these guys were... Oh, Dwayne, you were on the call last time, weren't you?
Well, actually, I dropped out of the call because I had something else I had to do, but I did listen later on and heard this inflammatory statement
okay.
that Robin made. So I certainly... agree, but I don't know what I would have said had I been on the call. I think I might have.
Well, okay, so right now, the proposal right now that Ned has made is that we formally apologize as a group to the guest for the comment that was made, and because he was actually invited to give us an informational briefing. And Ned, do you want to say anything here about?
I mentioned this to a couple of people. I know I talked to one other person here in Lafayette, Mike Booth. And is Mike on?
I think
Mike on tonight. Okay.
He was on, but he was on, but he dropped off.
Okay. Well, there was a consensus on his part also that it was a little offline. In the process of this, I was actually in touch with Ted Walters, and just from my own standpoint, and this is before this discussion about a group initiative, I'd kind of apologize for myself regarding what took place that evening. Ted's response to that was, well, he felt the majority of people were on board, and it didn't seem to be an issue with him. Considering what New York can has gone through over the years and dealing with New York authorities, it's, you know, they're not new to this posturing that occasionally comes their way. But I felt that it might be appropriate for us to discuss the way we treat guests and even discuss issues amongst ourselves. In light of what took place that evening.
Right. James, have you had a chance to hear, did you listen to that call after the fact? Did you hear it?
No, I have to confess I didn't. I'm not demanding to know because I feel like I kind of shirk my responsibility. But.
Well, Ned, you want to summarize what transpired in the best, to the best of your ability?
Well, as I recall, Robin made some remarks about Ted Walters' association with New York CAN and the fact that the initial initiative failed, and it almost sounded like that Ted Walters was being blamed on the failure of that former initiative.
If I may, he ran down the two, I guess there were two other previous initiatives, and he said that each of them had been more or less of a failure. I don't remember the exact word he used. And then he said, if this one fails, will you resign? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, gee.
Yeah.
No, there's nobody on our side failed, I don't think.
That was kind of the trigger that got my attention, and I.
This is Dwayne. Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, sure,
Derek. I felt like it was a little more than saying, "Will you resign?" I think he said it in a way that suggested maybe he should have resigned already. Because that he was absolutely not in favor of this current thing. That was really rubbing it in.
Yeah. So we've got two questions here. The first one is about what our protocol is with regard to guests in general. And the second one is, do we want to tender an apology, which I would be more than willing to put together and give to Ted on behalf of the group if there's an agreement here that he is owed an apology for having endured the rough treatment there when he was simply asked to come and give us information. Who would like to speak to either of those questions?
I so move.
Okay.
I second it.
The latter or the former? The latter. Okay, so the proposal for an apology has been moved and seconded.
Yeah.
And is there any objection to my putting together an apology on our behalf and sending it to Ted?
No objection.
Okay.
No. I think it should be worded in a way that expresses the solid support of the rest of us.
I'll say that it was a unanimous decision of the callers on our last call. It was out of order, and that he can certainly expect better treatment if he ever in the next time he comes back, and that we do want to maintain a good relationship with his outfit because we all agreed that we supported their efforts. So, I think that's just the thing. We want to keep it clear, and then we also are going on record as objecting to Robin's comment. Such that it creates a precedent, I believe, should it happen again, we might want to, take up the matter as in a more direct way, right?
Well, if Robin does that again, he ought to be reprimanded, I think.
Well, do you think we should not reprimand him in this case, but should wait for the future to...
Well, I think he's been a good member of this call, and I don't think so we ought to. I think he'll receive word of our action from that. I don't think we ought to ruffle his feathers, or he might not come back for quite a while.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right, so I think we have a plan that if everybody agrees with that, we can just let it go at that, and I'll put together the apology and send it to on behalf of the group. Okay. Any announcements? Does anybody have any announcements? Okay. Well, hearing no announcements, then I guess we've pretty well exhausted our time for the evening, so thank you all for sticking it out. And look forward to seeing you all last Wednesday of April.
Okay. Thank you, Ken.
Very good. Okay.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.